welcome to the Canine Conservationist Podcast, where we're positively obsessed with conservation detection dogs. Join us every other Tuesday to talk about detection training, canine welfare, conservation biology, and everything in between. I'm Kayla Fratt, one of three co-founders of Canine Conservationists, where we train dogs to detect data for researchers, NGOs, and agencies. Today, I want to start out with a shout out to our patron, Taylor, who's been putting a ton of work in not just with her two young and very talented dogs, but also on outreach and education to help get herself and her dogs out and working. Taylor has been a dedicated member of our Patreon for years now and is one of our most regular attendees of our group coaching calls. And it's been so cool to see her taking her dogs from struggling with holding alerts and mouthing hides to not just beautiful alerts, but also doing really impressive demonstrations and getting closer and closer to being fully operational. Well done, Taylor. Today, I am super excited to be bringing you an interview with Caroline Finlay of Conservation Detection Dogs of Northern Ireland. We've already had Caroline on the show before talking about moss and some very, very cool work there. And she is just continuing to absolutely wow me with very careful and thorough science and excellent dog training. This episode is going to really focus in on a fascinating pilot study that Caroline and her team did along with a bunch of really amazing partners to see if detection dogs can be used to find the nests of endangered curlews in Ireland. We're going to talk about why this matters, why the dogs may be helpful, all of the other methods that are being used to help protect curlews, because dogs are just one of many tools in the toolbox, and so much more. I love talking to Caroline. I wish that I could just interview her every week here. She's really one of the people I admire most deeply in this field, and I am just so excited to share this interview with you. This interview pulls relatively heavily from an article from the British Ecological Society, which is titled Conservation Detection Dogs Sniff Out Rare Curlew Nests, which you can find on the British Ecological Society's website. I recommend that you go ahead and check it out. It's very short, very easy to read, and I basically read this article and immediately reached out to Caroline. Because this episode is so science-heavy, and also because I am a very sleepy little PhD student, we don't have a science highlight this week, so let's get right into the interview with Caroline. All right, Caroline, welcome back to the podcast. I'm super excited to have you back on. Why don't you start out with anyone who maybe missed your first episode, or it's just been a long time. We do a lot of episodes. Remind us a little bit about yourself, your business, your dogs, and then we'll get into curlews.
Oh, yeah. I'm Caroline. I run a small business here in Northern Ireland called Conservation Detection Dogs Northern Ireland, or CDDNI. So I did my PhD in conservation back in the day. I then worked for a couple of conservation charities, and whilst working in one of those charities, I came across conservation detection dogs, and I went, yes, this is brilliant. We need this more, because it was, especially in the UK and Ireland, it was massively underutilized. And I was like, we need to make this more available for people, and especially charities who are always struggling to get the funding to find the data to actually prove their worth. So, working on a couple of charities then. In 2021, I went full-time doing conservation detection dogs. At that time, I had one dog. I now have four dogs.
Oops.
It was a big increase. We now have another handler working with us part-time, and she has a dog, and I'm sure in the next couple of years she will get more dogs. So, yeah, it has been great.
Oh, that's awesome. So, yeah, remind us about your dogs. I remember you've got a couple different breeds and a couple different kind of specialties on the team. So, and for anyone who wants to go back and find Caroline's other episode, obviously you could just search for Caroline's name, but it also was a really, really, really cool episode about moss. So make sure you go back to that. And I am not kidding when I say it was really, really cool. Like, that is not me being sarcastic about moss.
Everyone loves moss. Who doesn't love moss? I know.
Who doesn't love moss? Exactly.
So we have, myself, I have four dogs. So I've got Rufus, who's our veteran. He's now 10 years old, more semi-retired, but he started as a red squirrel detection dog. So helping us find red squirrels during squirrel pox outbreaks, which is because the American gray squirrel came in and decided to give this virus to all our squirrels.
Sorry.
not your fault. Not your fault, don't worry. Then we got into bat and bird carcass detection under turbines, like everybody does at some stage in their conservation detection dog career. And then we did seabird detection. So we were looking for Manx shearwater, which is this cool little seabird that lives down burrows and nests down burrows around Ireland and Britain. And then we have Monty, who was our second. These are both springers. I'm a big springer person. Monty, he is now 3. He's the only dog I've had from a puppy, so that was an experience.
Yeah.
And he is our main wind farm dog. He is, he will go through any vegetation. He will find anything in the middle of brambles and thorny bits. He's brilliant. He did a little bit of biosecurity work as well. And then we've got Zeba, who's our German short-haired pointer. Mm-hmm. So she's coming 6 in February. She has possibly the best nose I've ever come across in my life. So she was working mostly on the Moss project, does turbines as well. And then this is her new job, which is curlew nest detection. I know. And then we have Jasper, who has just turned 2. And we're hoping to imprint him on bat carcass to start off with for this season's bat work. So, yeah. Big family.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, actually, well, two sidebars that I hope our listeners will tolerate. Well, my dad just adopted a Springer Spaniel, so I now have a Springer in the family, and I'm very excited about it. She does not sound like the sort of dog that we would select for this sort of work. She's very timid and gentle and sweet and just kind of wants to trot along at his heel, which sounds perfect for him. But I am excited to have a Springer in the family now. And then have you read the book Coulter? It's by Rick Bass, and it's about, he's a bird hunter in Montana, conservationist guy, and it's one of those memoirs that kind of tells stories interwoven through his relationship with his dog, through kind of this, like, heart dog point of view, and I just finished reading it, and it's really, really beautiful, and there's some really cool stuff about scent work and ribbons of scent going across the plains and finding birds and stuff. I really, really enjoyed it, and I'm just telling all of my friends with pointers about it, so add it to the list. Okay, but let's get into curlews. This is actually, I think, the second episode we've got that talks about curlews. Our other with Show Rapley down in Australia was mostly focusing on finding dropped GPS units that had kind of come off of the curlews. So obviously this is a different species, I'm assuming. Tell us a little bit about these curlews, why they're in trouble, and why we care about them.
Yeah, so no, this is the Eurasian curlew. They are our largest wading bird, so kind of specializing in those kind of areas close to water, but not like fully in water, not like ducks and things like that there. And they have this massive long curved beak that they use, like probe into the ground to get insects and things like that. We care about them because they're an iconic species here, especially in Ireland. People grew up listening to this species calling with a really weird call, and they're bioindicators as well. So we use them as a measure for how well the farmland is, their farmland species. So how well are we actually looking and conserving different agricultural areas? Because they eat insects out of the soil. So if we're messing about with the soil, then we know about it because curlews aren't hanging around pretty much. Curlew are having a bad time of it. And people are like, it's so funny because I get a lot of people going, but I see curlew all over the place. And I'm like, yeah, you see wintering curlew. So in the UK and Ireland, we get a lot of curlew coming in from other countries because our winters are so mild. So they come from mainland Europe, they come from Scandinavia, and they're like, they stay here over winter, and we're like, oh my god, our population's massive. And then you get the breeding population and you go, oh no, because it is bad. So in Northern Ireland, we're in the last 40 years, we think we've lost over 80% of our breeding population. It's bad, yeah.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. Ireland as a whole, we've lost well over 90%.
Oh, yeah. No.
And then I think England, they think this over 60%. It's not good numbers.
No. Those are all numbers going in the wrong direction, unless you're talking invasive species mitigation, which we are not.
Yeah. So, it's pretty bad. There was a report done that was like, if we don't do something, pretty much in the next decade, we're looking at local extinctions. mm-hmm. because they're just not getting the population recovery that they need to yeah. build those numbers back up again. And there's mm-hmm. there's a couple of different reasons for it. So as I said, they like to breed on farmland, and farmland is an ever-changing landscape, and they just have not kept up with the changes. So mm-hmm. like grass cutting is happening more often. So unfortunately, mm-hmm. even if they do get the eggs hatching, the babies aren't getting to fledge because they're pretty much getting cut up whenever the silage is being cut.
Yeah, yikes.
Yeah, it's bad. There's not as much habitat for them because we keep draining fields for better agriculture. There's more predators now. Predators have numbers have increased, and we've shoved all these curlew into smaller areas, so it's mm-hmm. easier to predate on them. Yeah, it's all bad. They're not doing well.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it doesn't sound unfamiliar, and especially these sorts of smaller animals where increases in small predators can be a really big issue. I think a lot of our North American listeners are used to, you know, thinking about apex predator extermination or extirpation and how that may cause like herbivore populations to skyrocket, but it can also cause something called mesopredator release. And I don't know how much of that is a problem for you all, but I'm guessing it's like foxes and stuff that are doing really well and decimating these guys. Not like, you know, it's not like you've got brown bears roaming around doing this.
We don't have any interest in predators, put it that way. We don't, mm-hmm. we don't have any big cats. We don't have any bears or anything like that.
Yeah.
No, it's like foxes, badgers, different mustelids, species, and then you have mm-hmm. avian predators as well. So uh-huh. corvids, different raptors, and gulls. Gulls can be a big problem.
Yeah. I've got someone in my lab who's studying raven interactions with sage grouse, and it's really surprising. I'd never thought about ravens as a really important predator for other birds in particular. I guess I don't know what I was thinking that ravens ate, but I wasn't thinking about poor sage grouse getting hammered by them as well. We'll get him on the show at some point just because he's a really good science communicator and he does some cool work, even though it doesn't involve the dogs. So, okay. So now how do dogs come into this? Like, are we trying to point out these curlews so that we can trap them and put them in breeding facilities? Are we trying to find nests? What are we doing? And what's kind of the plan there?
So we're trying to find nests. Uh-huh. If we can find the nest, we can put anti-predator fencing around the nest. It's pretty much a glorified electric fence for like livestock, uh-huh. but it's a bit more like there's a couple more strands and things to try and put off foxes and badgers from getting to them. Mm-hmm. So if we can find this, we can do that. And there it is shown that there's like a massive, massive increase in the chance that the eggs will actually hatch and get to mm-hmm. hatching if we can get these fences around them.
So
that's why I was brought in. I was actually brought in, the first time I was ever, this was ever mentioned to me, was by a poor person who had to stand out in a field for hours at a time trying to find out where these nests are. And he was please help me.
Please, I don't want to do this.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I was like, yeah, no, that's dead on. I don't blame you. So
no.
Yeah. And he was like, a dog would be so good.
So what do we know, and maybe do we know, like, so it sounds like getting the eggs to hatch is a big problem, and then getting the chicks to fledging. What do we know about kind of these big drop-off points or bottlenecks in, like, the life cycle of these birds? Is it kind of like, if we get the eggs to hatch, then that helps a bunch with the bottleneck, or then do we kind of have, like, another step as far as getting them to adulthood and to ultimately breeding again and trying to get this population all the way, you know?
Yeah. If we can get the eggs to hatch, now I'm not a curlew expert. I should say that at the start. I'm sure I work with a lot of people who are curlew experts, and I'm sure they're going to be like, Caroline, I have all the figures here. And I'd be like, oh damn, I should have got this before this. But if we can get the eggs to hatch, that's a major hurdle. Half the time it's the eggs get predated. It's when they're the most vulnerable. The chicks themselves are so well camouflaged, and they have their own kind of ability to hide from predators, but the nests are just completely vulnerable. There's nothing that they can do to avoid predators, unfortunately. And there are other things that these different charities are putting in place, and different landowners put in place. Like, they are doing removing predators from the environment and things like that to try and help. But if they can't find the nest, it really causes a trouble. And it's really hard to measure then how well the population's doing if we can't find the nest as well. So
totally. Yeah, that makes sense. I know I'm kind of throwing some extra questions at you then. Well, we have some leeway as far as, like, we understand you're the dog person here. That's all right. Okay, so tell us a little bit about, you know, when I first heard about y'all, it's basically, I've known about you for a while, but I have a Google Scholar alert set up for conservation dogs, conservation detection dogs, ecological dogs, you know, all of the permutations of that. And you were mentioned in the British Ecological Society for this work. So tell us a little bit about kind of what this study was, because one of the things we were talking right before I hit record that I really admire about you, and this project is such a great example of this, is the level of scientific rigor that you're bringing to this. You're not just like, sure, yeah, I've got a pointer, we'll go find the birds, and then we'll do the thing, and then we're done. Like, there was a lot that went into this. So tell us a little bit about what you've been up to so far.
Yeah, so I was first approached about curlew nest detection in 2021. And it was after that breeding season, and they found like one nest in this area of Northern Ireland, and they were like, this is ridiculous. And they're spending days on end looking for nests. It's not as if the effort isn't there. It's just that the birds are trying to also hide them from you, so they're not landing straight on them. They are extremely well camouflaged, so you could be standing beside them and not know you're standing beside them. Mm-hmm. And then it's a massive area as well that you need to search. Yeah. So there's different reasons. And he came to me in 2021 and went, right, please help us. And then I was right, brilliant, okay. 2022 came and I went, right, we need to actually prove that dogs can do this. Because we had a lot of doubters. So we had people going, you're taking dogs onto curlew nesting habitat? No, that is ridiculous. That is crazy. These are extremely fragile habitats and extremely, like, decimated populations of bird species. Taking a dog on is crazy. And I was like, fair. So we kind of had to prove ourselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we ran this pilot study. And what we did was we got some of the researchers that we knew that were working on curlew, we got them to put get scent tubes into curlew nests for us and post them back to us. And then we put trained Zeba on the get scent tubes. Mm-hmm. And then we tested her looking for the get scent tubes in a certain area. And we tested her against people looking for a fake nest or two fake nests in the same kind of area. And we were trying to see, first of all, is the dog actually better than people? If a person can, like, if they can kind of work out that there's a nest in an area, can they actually find it? And then is the dog actually better at finding the odor than we are at finding the visual? Just to make sure that this is actually worth pursuing.
Right.
Because, yeah, it is. It's a big ask to say to someone, you know, you're a really heavily protected species. Is it okay if we take a dog in to find it?
Right. And especially when we're looking at, you know, you're not just taking it into that animal's territory or habitat, and you're not just finding the adults, you're actually finding the nests. You know, this is a huge ask, and it's something that, you know, I think we all hopefully in this field take really, really seriously, but we just can't say enough, like, how important it is that we know what we're doing and that we've got the right dogs for the job and all the stuff that I'm sure you're about to tell us about.
Yeah, exactly. So first of all, I picked Zeba because she is a pointer. She works slower than the spaniels do. She's more methodical. She also instinctually goes into a point. So if a chick kind of runs out in front of her, she'll go into a point before anything else. Whilst the boys, they don't have it. They would be more likely to flush a bird.
Sure, supposed to do.
Yeah, it's built in.
You know, before you trained them, that's what their genetics were telling them to do.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a safety device on the pointer. she already has the point built in, and it was so interesting. So we actually compared her searching for the curlew nest odor against a person who had never searched for curlew nests before and a person who was an expert at finding curlew nests. So someone who had done it for a couple of years. And then we picked two different environments as well. So two different habitats that you would find curlew nests in to see if that made a difference. It was interesting, whenever we got the curlew nest get sent tubes over back to us, we actually tested, could Zeba find them in a whole load of different habitats, just in case they just smelled of like heather or like long grass.
Right.
Or like, you know, because we weren't, you know, you stick a get sent tube into a nest and you hope it smells of nest. But yeah, we were pretty confident after testing it in like a whole load of different environments that, yeah, this definitely smells of something different, something that's special. So no, that was good. So yeah, there was, do you want to hear the results?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Zeba found 93% of the nests that we put out for her. Yeah. The I always say the reason she missed the nests that she missed, it was my fault as handler, not her fault as dog. So yeah, I always say like I sometimes prefer it to be my fault than her fault. So yeah, I need to improve, not the dog needs to improve. And then the expert human only found 43% of the nests, and the non-expert who had never done it before found around 60% of the nests. So you're still looking at quite a few that were missed. Yeah, it was interesting. And then the humans put together only found around the 50% mark of the nests that were actually put out. So
yeah. Wait, so can you say it again? So the novice searcher found like 40-some percent and the expert found like 60-some percent, or did I get that backwards?
Backwards.
Weirdly. Okay, that's what I thought you said, and that's what I wanted to confirm. Wow, okay, so the expert found fewer. Do we think that's because they had some like preconceived notion of where it's supposed to be?
We're
speculating a little.
Exactly, we are speculating, but I also think we did this trial in August, so they had worked a full season before we asked them to do it.
I'm tired.
Burnout is a possibility.
Yeah.
Also, yeah, they had a preconceived notion that I have searched and I haven't found. Done. They were much quicker at calling a blank area than the novice was. And I think that is because the novice was like, I've never done it before, I'm going to try really hard. And
Yeah, and I wonder how long that effect would wear off, and if it would wear off, or if you would find as strong of an effect. Were people observing them during the search?
Yeah, so we had Beth, our wonderful master's student, so she was observing the entire time, yeah.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, again, we're speculating here, but I know the times that I have known that I am being watched while I'm searching, I often search differently than and I'm less confident calling blanks when people are watching me. It's scary. And I'm sure if you do enough of that practice, it wears off. But yeah. Gosh. So okay, so that's really impressive. So yeah, we're kind of at this point where, okay, we've confirmed that Zeba can find these get scent tubes that we're pretty sure correlate to the scent of the nest. And now is the next question kind of, can we do this without getting the curlews to abandon the nests?
So
what's the plan for that?
Yeah. Oh, this is the trial that we're having this year that everybody's really, really excited about. So that kind of pilot study has been like what we've sent to everyone and been like, look, there is a possibility. I called it the potential of the dogs. Yeah. I was like, look, there's potential here that this is actually worth us looking more into. It is worth us going into these areas with dogs. And I always say, it's hilarious. These curlew are nesting on agricultural areas with sheep and cattle that are being driven by dogs all the time. They have sheepdogs out running around the place and people are still worried about bringing dogs onto the site. And I'm like, no, don't worry about that. But let's see what happens. So yeah. There's an area in Northern Ireland that has a recovering curlew population. It's one of the only areas in Ireland that is actually showing an increase in curlew chick numbers at the moment and actually getting them to fledge. And they are spending weeks upon weeks finding nests, and they're being very successful at finding nests in this particular area. And it's maybe because they know where the curlew nests are. Like curlew have a lot of site fidelity, so they're they always go back to the same areas, so they already have a lot of knowledge on where the curlew nests are going to be. So but that is perfect for us because then we can actually do some really interesting trials in that area. And they don't have a population where there's only one nest, maybe in like 800 hectares, which is in some areas, that's what we're looking at. Yes.
Yikes.
So in that area, we're picking a two different sites within that area. One, we're going to use the dog to help us find curlew nests, and one is just going to be human searchers trying to find the nests. And this is step one. And what we're going to look at is like, first of all, how much quicker it is with the dog. Is it quicker? Are we actually finding more? And how long it takes the curlews to return to the nest once we've actually found it. Are we finding that they're staying off the nest a lot longer? Are they possibly abandoning it? Although I'll be honest, having chats with some of the other curlew workers now, I'm actually thinking, I don't see it happening, but you never know.
That's why we check.
And then we're looking at like, there's younger pairs coming in now who aren't as experienced. Are they more likely to abandon if a dog comes in compared to maybe the more veteran curlews who have had nests all over the place and are like, this is easy buns, don't worry. So we're testing these two areas. Once we have a notion of the disturbance that we're actually causing, then we're going to take the dogs into the bigger areas where we really don't know as well where the curlew nests are, and that's where we're properly going to really evaluate how useful the dogs are going to be, because that's what most people are actually dealing with, is that they have these vast areas with maybe one or two curlew nests in them and they just can't pinpoint them.
I mean, I really love highlighting just how multi-stage this process is. And I wanted to circle back to, I think it's a really good point that these curlews are nesting in, as you said, kind of agricultural landscapes, working landscapes. And it's actually something we're running into with another project partner right now, where they've got a lot of worries and a lot of questions about the conservation dogs. And we're more than happy to answer all of those and really happy to work with them. And after a couple calls, at some point, they mentioned that this area that we're going to be working in is open rangeland, where, you know, there's cattle and dogs and horse people moving through it at least a couple times a year, you know, not necessarily on a day-to-day basis. And it's like, oh, okay. You know, I mean, again, like, it doesn't negate the concerns about the dogs, but it does suggest to us that if these animals were going to keel over and die at the sight of a dog, they would have done it already. The other thing that I'm glad you mentioned is that you don't really suspect that these birds are going to be abandoning their nest. It's really good to check. It's going to be so great to have the information saying whether or not they do, at what percentage they do. You know, ideally they don't. But I would suspect that you wouldn't have gone this far along this project if you and all of the experts really thought, like, gosh, you know, using the dogs is going to cause as many problems as it solves, we probably wouldn't be here right now.
100%. Like, so there are a couple of safety measures we're putting in to kind of reduce disturbance. It's at some amount. So we're only searching for 20 to 40 minutes max. We've put that in as soon as the bird flushes off the nest, a curlew lifts off nest, then we have a time limit where if we don't find the nest within that 20 minutes, then that's it, we call it. Back off again to let the bird come back in and get back on its nest. We're not doing it in cold weather, in rainy weather, because we don't want the eggs just out there in the environment in any form of danger. We also, when I did the pilot study, I did it with the dog online, and on a leash, on a big lead, and that was because I knew they were going to ask me for it. Whenever we came to actually do it in the environment, and I was like, it will slow I've said this to them, it will slow the dog down, but if it makes you feel better, if it makes us feel better, if it's a safety line that you need in, 100%, we will work within that. One of the things they have added this year is that they want us to work the dog with a muzzle on as well. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I was like, dead on, if that's what you want, 100% we can muzzle train them. I do say to them though, like, another reason why I picked Zeba is that she has a habit of hitting odor, stopping, and then working like excessively slowly into it sometimes. And you're like, it's nice. You know, if you're working on something that's as delicate as an egg, it's a really nice process that she has working in to actually pinpoint.
Yeah, I wouldn't want Niffler on this project because he has a habit of occasionally lying down on his sample. We're working on it. He's gotten so much better. Thanks to, I've been working through a lot of like Paul Bunker's workbook, working on getting really good, you know, freeze stare sorts of alerts, and it's helping a lot. But got his first two seasons, he was, you know, sternum crushing bats, and that would be a real big problem with eggs.
100%. And then we're putting camera traps out on the nest as well once we find them, so we can get some type of behavioral data as well. Like, are the birds calling more? Do they have a distress call more if the dogs are in the area or not? So yeah, it's gonna be interesting. We have put in a couple of those measures to try and reduce disturbance as much as possible.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, this sounds huge. How Did you have to get additional funding for the dogs, or did your partners kind of come to you with, you don't have to tell us about the budget here, but like, this sounds like a really big in-depth thing that, you know, we just don't always have the opportunity to put together something like this in our line of work.
Oh yeah. So the pilot study was pretty much funded all by ourselves, because we had, and it was hilarious, we had all the field workers coming to us and going, please, please get us a dog, please, 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 we're desperate. And a lot of the people that were maybe higher ups or not in the field as much were going, oh no, we can't take a dog out into these sites. Like, it is, you know, that's crazy. So we were like, right, we need to prove it to them. So we paid pretty much everything ourselves. We did get it. So Beth was our master's student from Queen's University Belfast. We worked with the university quite a bit. And she came with a small amount of funding, and that paid for the get sent tubes, pretty much. The nest. So this year we have actually been able to get some funding from some of the projects that are already on the ground. And it's pretty much, they've gone, this is now desperate measures. Like, we desperately need to find nests. Like, they've been in some of the areas, they've been working for years and they're still not getting the number of chicks fledged that they need to keep that population at a steady state. Or they actually need it over that amount to actually recover.
Yeah, they don't just need two chicks making it to sexual maturity. They need more in order to have that population actually grow. Yeah. And based on the picture in the article, it looks like there was four eggs in the picture. So it's not like, I think sometimes people think that, you know, you see like swallows will have like maybe eight chicks, or, you know, ducks, you know, you see some of these like mergansers in the US where they'll have like 15 babies. I think sometimes they accidentally adopt or like merge broods. But yeah, it's small numbers here. And I would imagine if a fox or a badger or whomever finds four eggs, they're probably going to munch all four.
Pretty much. And so, yeah, four eggs is kind of the maximum that they'll have in a nest. And that's the number that we used for the trial as well of the human searchers. We put our fake four eggs in the nest for them. Also, so they will try to have a second brood if they successfully fledge their chicks. But if chicks are predated on, they won't try again. They just give up, pretty much. So, yeah, it is. They're an interesting bird species. Also, they take quite a long time to mature for a bird. It can be up like, 4 years? I think I was told. It'll take them 4 years until they're old enough to actually want to create a...
Guys, like, grow up.
I know.
So it's not, and this is just, I guess, one of the things kind of going back to my earlier question about, you know, the egg protection versus fledging versus, you know, gosh, I'm sure there's a ton of drop off between fledging and your first successful brood, which may or may not even happen your first year. But also getting this fencing up around these eggs is the thing that we can do. You can't bubble wrap a fledgling bird until it reproduces at 4 or, you know, maybe even more years old. And if you're off a little bit on the 4 years, you know, I think the point stands that, again, this isn't a bird that it's coming back next year and starting to contribute to the population growth right away.
100%. And then, so there's been some head starting projects in other parts of the UK. They haven't started it in Northern Ireland yet. I think they only just started it in Ireland, maybe last year, the year before. And that's where they're actually removing the eggs from the wild and they're raising them in captivity. They're giving them a head start. They're raising them in captivity until they're close to fledging and then putting them back into the wild again to try and like boost those numbers. So they've been doing this more in England, and we should this year see how successful some of those populations are going to be, because cool. those young chicks are now coming back old enough to actually have their own babies. So yeah, we shall see how that works. But that's
fingers crossed for
the dogs. Like, head starting is perfect just for the dogs, because you don't care about disturbance, because the eggs are getting removed from the environment anyway.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Will the curlews ever re-nest if you take their eggs away? Okay, yeah, so it actually, you might be able to even get a twofer out of that. That's excellent. Yeah, and I think, you know, there are successful-ish examples of this. I don't know enough to speak super confidently about any of them, but, you know, I know we've been doing that in the Americas with our condors. We've done it with our whooping cranes, and, you know, it's tricky. It's hard work, and it's expensive, and it's a lot of work. But it has been done before, and it seems like one of the things that helps with birds is if you can avoid imprinting and get the migration stuff figured out, they usually do okay versus, you know, I know I've read a little bit about like cheetah reintroduction or African painted dogs and some of those things where they have to, there's so much social learning that happens, and that can be really, really tricky to recreate in a captive environment. And again, people are doing great work on that sort of stuff, but in some ways birds are maybe a little easier.
Yeah, well, there's a project in Ireland where they're head starting corncrake, which is another bird that's having a rough time of it. And they have to not let the chicks see the night sky until they're released into where they would like them to breed, because their sight fidelity is based on the night sky. It's really interesting.
That's crazy. Who figured that out? And how? That's so cool. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Wow. So are they in, they're in like little domes?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah, again, I mean, gosh, I know a little bit more about some of the carnivore projects, and I remember reading one about these African painted dogs where they had like, they'd fenced in like 100 hectares or something. You know, it was a huge area that they had fenced in to try to get the dogs, you know, stepped up to successfully hunting before they were being introduced to lions, because they, you know, they're just getting munched by lions right and left. And this one paper that I was reading just talked about how quickly the dogs learned to just drive the impala or antelope or whatever it is that they were hunting straight into the fence and straight into the corners of the fence. And it was like, it just doesn't, you can have this enclosure that seems like it should be big enough that they can practice, but they're smart enough that they just start learning to use the fence. And it's just, I mean, some of the unforeseen problems with these reintroduction things, like, I mean, hats off to the people who do it, because I don't know if I can handle it emotionally.
100%, yeah. There's a fella I do a bit of training with. He's come with his dog, and he had baby curlews that he was raising from a head starting project down in the Republic of Ireland, and he was exhausted.
He was coming up
knackered, and I was like, oh dear, are you okay? And he's like, yeah, the curlews kept me up last night, you know, that kind of way.
So. Yeah, I've done bottle baby orphaned kittens, and yeah, you know, and that's a domestic species, so at least them I can be like, all right, I'm going to put them in a basket on my bed, so if they're upset in the middle of the night, I can just, like, stick my hand in there, and they'll shut up, hopefully. but when they're, you know, like, 4 to 8 weeks old, I will just, like, I've got bags under my eyes that go down to my nose, like, it's rough. Yeah. Okay. So is there anything else before we just devolve into totally total side conversations that we should be talking about or thinking about as far as curlews? Is there anything else you're excited about or concerned about?
Yeah, so this project is with RSPB, if anybody wants to look them up, and you can look up some of the work. Like that, I'm completely bypassing the amount of habitat management they've done. Yeah. I'm completely like, and amount of like predation control, amount of like work that they've put into the background. I'm just like, we're finding nests. The dogs are going to save the day, but they've actually done a ton
so
of
much.
Work.
Yeah.
This is just going to be an extra tool for them to have in their toolbox that they can pull out whenever they need it. And look up the Glenwary site in County Antrim and Upper Loch Earn in Fermanagh. Those are the two sites we're going to be working in, and they're beautiful. And the farmers on both those sites have been amazing. And yeah, some of the local groups as well have been absolutely fantastic. And I think like a lot of these areas are privately owned, and if you don't get the landowners on side and willing to help you, you're stuffed. So they've been absolutely fantastic.
Oh yeah, that's great. No, and again, I think it's really important to just acknowledge, yeah, the dogs are just one of the tools in the toolkit, and how many people it takes to come together and make all of this work. You know, we on this podcast tend to talk to the handlers, the trainers, and we're trying to not just do that, but you know, that's who I'm most excited to talk to. And it's always a team effort, and there's so many people behind so much of this. And you know, I'm sure you've got, you know, maybe not particularly in this one, but in a lot of other cases, we've got statisticians and computer scientists and modelers. And you know, maybe I'm just thinking about that a lot, because that's what I'm learning how to do in my PhD right now. And I'm just like, oh my God, thank God there are people who have this as their area of expertise, because you know, we need so many people to get this sort of stuff up and off the ground. It is so much more than scent equals toy, go out for a walk with your dog.
I was a data analyst for a while in a previous life, and like that's when you truly realize how big projects are, when they have to bring a data analyst in. You're like, oh, there's like 100 people on this project. Like,
oh no,
one species, like it is nuts. Yeah.
Yeah, yep, exactly. It's and it's a lot of work, and it's really important, because if you don't do a good job of that, then it's really hard to say anything about the work that you're actually doing. So well, Caroline, I think we're going to let you go. Again, thank you so much for coming on and being willing to talk to me about this. This was one of those things where I think I saw this paper come up and I just emailed you immediately. And I was like, Caroline, you've got to come back on the show. We had such a good time the first time, and this is such neat science. So really hats off to y'all, and you know, for being willing and able to put that funding together to make this pilot study happen, and being really, really careful about this, because I think it would have been really easy to walk away or to push for something that maybe got it done quote unquote faster, but wouldn't be nearly as scientifically rigorous. And you know, really, that's something I hugely admire about y'all. Yeah. All right. Well, so remind us where people can find you online, if there are any other links that you need, if you can email them over to me, just so that I make sure I'll get all the spelling right and get those notes in for the show notes. But where can people find you online?
Yep. So best place to go is our website. So that's cddni.com, and that's got all our like social media thingies on it, so you can find us. And we've got a couple of publications coming out really soon, so I will send them to you as well.
Yay!
You're all welcome to come join the Ecological Detection Dogs Working Group of Britain and Ireland as well, because we have some really, really cool stuff happening there. Please come and join us, and we're looking for input into a whole load of stuff at the minute, so be much, much welcome.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. No, I really admire a lot of the work that you guys are doing over there. Really great stuff. So, and for everyone at home, as you probably already know, now it is your job to get outside and be a canine conservationist in whatever way suits your passions and skill set. And if you need more information about canine conservationists, if you want to get one-on-one coaching, if you want to join group coaching calls, or just support the podcast, that's over at patreon.com/canineconservationists. And then you can buy stickers and t-shirts and sign up for our our course and just look at cute pictures of our dogs or find our social media. That's at caninconservationists.org. We'll be back in your earbuds, not next Tuesday, but the Tuesday after. Thanks. Bye.